This is the SNO Friday Night Speaker Meeting, held at El Paseo Shopping Center, room 120, in San Jose, California, on July 26th, I hope, 1993. Tonight, our 10-minute speaker will be Grant D, and our main speaker will be Hank C. The original recording and its copy are at the SNL Tape Library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. And please do not break the anonymity of speakers or any AA member at the public level. I thank you very much.
Everybody, my name is Grant and I'm an alcoholic. Years, I believe. I want to thank the Lord for asking me to come here. This is about the fifth time that I've had the opportunity to, you know, come up and speak at the Friday night speakers meeting. And I kind of look at it as a blessing, you know, doing the 10-minute job and all that, because I would avoid wanting to do that hour job. That's a little bit too much for me. So 10 minutes is just about right for me. And My foot found it. Can you hear me? Okay. You know what? I'm not going to get into my drunk log, and I'll tell you why. Because I think the condition I was in when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous pretty well summed it up, and that was that I had no place to live. My family didn't want anything to do with me anymore. I had the very real possibility of probably spending a good majority, if not all, of my adult life in a federal prison, and that's where I was at when I hit the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I got here for what I hope is to stay in these rooms, I had a lot of experience behind me of coming in and out of these rooms for a real long time, and I had a long association with the 12-step programs due to a family member's drinking when I was growing up. So I knew the day I hit these doors what was going to be required of me when I got here. And the thing I love to talk about is that, you know, I sometimes don't think, you know, until we've been around these rooms for a while till we realize, you know, how devastating this disease of alcoholism is, and what it does to us, you know, when we first get here. And even with all the information that I had up to that point, still, that, you know, that part of our disease, that denial, just ran rampant in me. And yet, at the same time, too, when I got here this last time, you know, I knew deep down inside, you know, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about conceding to our innermost self that we are alcoholic. And that is exactly what happened to me. And you know what, when that day that I got back to these rooms, there was something that had happened deep down inside of me. And you know, it wasn't something that I wrote out, it wasn't something that I sat there and I talked to anybody about. It was an intuition, it was a knowledge, and it was something that was so strong deep down inside of me that there was no way for me to deny the nature of my disease. I could no longer deny that I was an alcoholic. And I believe that was the first step in action for me. And from there on in, you know, it was all about getting hooked up with a sponsor and, you know, starting to do this the way it was supposed to be done. Because in my various trips in and out of AA, you know, prior to this last time, I did absolutely everything people told me not to do. You know, I would come late, you know, for the beginning of the meeting. I would leave early before the meeting ended. You know, I didn't get phone numbers. I didn't talk to anybody. I didn't get a sponsor. I only got a sponsor one time in one of my early excursions in the AA. I had about 2 weeks and he had about 3 weeks, you know. And I called him up one night with this real heavy-duty problem, and I don't even remember what this heavy-duty problem was, but I'm sitting there to this guy, spilling my guts. He turns around with his hot 3 weeks, spills his guts, and we both said, fuck it, went out and got drunk together. And so I would strongly suggest to anybody who's new in here, if you get a sponsor, I would make sure they've been around for a considerable bit of time. So, and at least have gone through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. But you know what, that's the way it was for me. And I keep hating to say the last time, you know, for me, but that's what I believe was the last time. I felt for a very, very long time And I realize that this program is a one-day-at-a-time program, and it's based on our daily spiritual maintenance. But I can tell you, my experience, you know, on that day has kind of convinced me that, you know, if I do what you people tell me to do, I'm never going to take another drink as long as I live. And that was pointed out to me very early on in my sobriety by my sponsors, that when we come to these rooms, you know, sure, it's important to remember it's one day at a time, but when we come to these rooms, we need to make a lifetime commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous and sobriety. And that's what I did. And, you know, for me, by the grace of God, it hasn't been necessary for me to take a drink since December 25th of 1981. And so I've had the privilege of staying around here a real long time in my eyes and in my life. But I'm going to tell you what, you know, there's been a lot of work that I've had to do. I was told very early on that sobriety is not handed to us on a silver platter. God does not come down out of the heavens and sprinkle us with sobriety dust and say, you're healed, go out and be wonderful. It doesn't go like that, you know. What I've come to understand is, when we come into Alcoholics Anonymous, what we're coming in to learn how to do is to, you know, find this power that is greater than ourselves that's going to enable us to solve our problem. And I believe today that, you know, I've been fortunate enough to do that. I've got a God that works in my life today in ways that I don't understand, nor do I want to understand. I just like letting him, you know, do what it is that he does, you know. And the neat thing about it is that through all of this and despite everything, you know, I've had some pretty good experiences and some pretty wild times in sobriety. And you know, just a couple of things that, you know, that I've come to learn about Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I got here, okay, you know, the book talks about countless vain attempts to try to drink like other people, you know. Well, I got to look at that in the light of that my whole life was a countless vain attempt, okay. And I didn't have a lot going for me. And so, it was real hard, you know, for me to grasp a lot of the things that my sponsor was telling me early on. And, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous has changed an awful lot over the last 11 and a half years since I've been here. But one of the things that I'm eternally grateful for, and I don't see it a lot in AA anymore, and a lot of people don't necessarily agree with me on this, but, you know, I can only share my experience, strength, and hope. And that is that my sponsor told me in no uncertain terms what it was that I was going to have to do to stay sober. He said, if you want to stay sober, this is what you will do. He says, if you don't do this, you will be drunk. Okay? And he never once ever suggested to me that I do anything. He told me what I was going to do. And I remember very clearly one time that when we were just getting ready to go into the steps, you know, I thought I used to have that little angle shooting that we want to do. I thought I was going to put this really slick job on him and, you know, read the book inside and out and be just prepared for anything that he had to come back with me at. And he said, okay, we're going to get going on the steps. And I said, well, the steps are suggested. And he looked at me and he says, well, you know what, I suggest you work the steps or I'm going to break your knees. And so, you know, he had an assortment of other little four-letter words strung in here, but this is, you know, we're trying to clean this act up here, so I'm not going to throw that in. But anyway, he had the foresight and he had the experience of his sobriety to know the type of individual I was, and he kind of like planned my activities for me in AA. And I use as an example, he called me one night and says, congratulations, you are the new intergroup, alternate intergroup rep for Saturday Night Live. And I said, do I have anything to say about this? And he says, no, you don't. Congratulations, you're the new alternate intergroup rep for Saturday Night Live. And, you know, thank God that he knew that about me. And it taught me very early on the importance of being in service, you know, to Alcoholics Anonymous and, you know, the people in these rooms. And he says, because you know what? He says, you can't afford to have idle time on your hands. And he says, the more work I can load you up with, the better chance you are you're going to be around these rooms. And so, you know, I flew blind, you know, for a long time doing this stuff, not knowing what I was doing. But deep down inside, I just kind of had this gut feeling that, you know what, if I stuck with this guy and if I did what he told me to do, at some point in time, a lot of this stuff is going to come together and I'm going to understand it. And, you know, over the last 11 years, I've tried to do the same things today that I started doing back then. And I have the advantage now of, you know, having a little bit better understanding of what Alcoholics Anonymous is about, what God's will for me is, you know, what it is that I need to do to stay here on a daily basis. Because I'll tell you what, you know, in the 11 and a half years that I've been in these rooms, I'll tell you what, I've watched more people leave Alcoholics Anonymous than stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it has been my experience that the ones who stay are the ones who are actively involved in service. They're actively involved in, you know, doing other things, you know, around Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, secretary meetings, getting involved in general service and things of that nature. So, you know, if you're new tonight, or if you know you don't understand a lot about you know what it takes to stay here, that's okay. You know, come and talk to the people that have been around here for a while. You know, because I found that my greatest source of strength and the thing that helps me the most is going out and talking. I like using the word old timers because it just doesn't sit well with me. But I like going out and talking to these people that have, you know, 10, 15, 20, you know, 30 years of sobriety and all that, because, you know, they've got a lot of experience under their belts. And they know, you know, what you can expect, and, you know, share that with you and help you work through these things. Because I'm going to tell you what, the longer I'm around these rooms, the narrower the path becomes, you know. And I don't have the same options that I had when I was 2 or 3 years sober, okay? It's come down to, I've gotten to a point in my life in sobriety to where, you know what, things have come down to a very, very black and white, a right or wrong type of a situation. And, you know, the book talks about either God is or he isn't, you know. And that's how I look at sobriety. Sobriety is or sobriety isn't, you know. And if I want sobriety, then you know what? There's certain things that I'm going to have to do irregardless of how long I've been around these rooms. And I have to continue to do them on a daily basis. Otherwise, I'm not going to be here. Yeah, I've had a lot of ups and downs. I've had a lot of, you know, pain and misery, you know, in my sobriety, but I can guarantee you that it's small compared to the joy and to the good times that I've had in Alcoholics Anonymous. I do things in my life today. You know, when I was drinking, I used to be one of these people in the summer. Now, I was thinking about this the other day. You know, I used to lay there in my apartment on a hot summer day with the drapes closed, and you got a can of beer, and you're watching whatever it is you're watching on TV, and they got all these beer commercials, and everybody's out at the beach having a big old glamorous time, you know. And I used to be that person who just sit there and going, God, you know, how come that doesn't happen to me, you know. It never occurred to me that, you know, it had anything to do with my drinking or anything like that. Well, you know what, today I don't sit in my house. Well, I did today, but I don't sit there with the drapes closed and a can of beer or a can of Diet Coke today, and I'm sitting there, gee, I wish I could go out and do that. I go out and I do those things today. You know, I've had more fun in sobriety than I've ever had in my life. I have done things in sobriety that I always wished I could do but never could do because of my drinking, you know. Alcohol is a pretty devastating thing in our lives. The disease of alcoholism, I don't know, you know, the longer I'm around here, the more I come to hate it and all that, but at the same time, too, I've got a lot of respect for that disease. Today I've got a lot of respect because I understand how powerful it is. I just thank God that we have this thing here today called Alcoholics Anonymous, so we can overcome these problems. Because I'm gonna tell you what, you think about it, you know, 60 years ago, people like us were screwed, plain and simple. We were screwed. You know, we were consigned to a life of misery, institutions, jails, and death. And I just feel fortunate that, you know, I was around at a time in history that, you know, allowed this thing of Alcoholics Anonymous to be here, so I didn't have to live that pain and misery that my grandfathers and, you know, fathers had to live and things of that nature. So, if you're new in here tonight, you know, I'd encourage you, you know, find somebody who's been around these rooms for a while. Okay, somebody's gone through the 12 steps and's got some experience under their belt. You know, hook up with them and, you know, don't just hang on for the ride. I mean, you know, let them show you what sobriety is about and what it does, you know, what we need to do to stay here. Because I'm going to tell you what, you know, you might not think it now, but I can guarantee you if you do those things, you know, your life is going to change in ways that you can't even conceive. And I think that's just about my time. I thank my friend Dolores for asking me to do this, and I'd encourage you all, you know, to stay here and, you know, and enjoy this thing called sobriety, because we've got a new lease on life. Thank you.
You know, I never know what I'm going to say because I only have one story. But I like what the young man's talked about. They talked before I did. We talked about the disease being kind and baffling and powerful. You know, when I got here, I thought it was just tired. When I got here, I thought that all I had to do was, I went to a treatment center up in Santa Cruz, And I thought that's all I had to do was go up there and relax and I'd be okay. Because they talk about denial, talk about being kind and baffling and powerful. I thought that's all I had to do and I'd be okay. I thought it was my wife. If my wife would get off my ass, I'd be okay. I thought if this business thing wasn't so, you know, all these people that I owe money to, get out, if they would only get off my ass, I'd be okay. And I thought that if San Jose wasn't so big, I'd be okay. And on and on and on and on, you know, and I believed it. And I believed it because I knew that if I could only relax, I'd be okay. See, all my life I believed it. I believed that if I could only relax, I'd be okay. So all my life I tried to relax. Sometimes I would over-relax, you know, and that's what happened. You know, by the time I got here, I left my wife and kids. I had left the business that I had for over 20-some years. And I was living with my brother and I was drinking wine. And I never drank wine. You know, I loved wine, but I just didn't drink wine, just wine. And by the time I got here, that's all I was doing. And I walked away from the business. I just left it. And somehow, I thought, I didn't know what the hell I thought. I knew that if these people that were after me would stop working for me, I'd be okay. See, I used to get my wife to change her phone at home every 2 or 3 months because I knew the phone was broken. And I would go to work, different ways to work, because I knew I was being followed. And I was really paranoid, and I was getting ready to buy a gun. When my daughter went to a high school prom, I hired a bodyguard for her because I knew someone was after us. And one time I was home on a Saturday morning, I was a little loaded. I was in the family room, where I spend most of my time. And I was, I saw this wagon, this panel truck drive up. And my wife had just called the people, I called the phone company to come and change her phone again. And I see this guy drive up. And in those days there was something on TV called Mission Impossible. You know, and I thought, well, these guys are, you know, they're looking for me. The phone company guys didn't work on Saturday. So I grabbed this gun and I chased these guys off. It was a BB gun, but they didn't know it. And so that's the way my life was for the last 2 years. And I share this, man, because there might be somebody out there in the same boat. There might be somebody out there that things are looking for them. And he's afraid. And I would not tell anybody. I knew they were looking for me. Who the hell was they going to tell? I remember telling him, yeah, I told someone, and they looked at me kind of funny. Like, this guy's really nuts. And you know, that's where I was. But I didn't know it. I thought that if these guys would, if I could only relax, I could think this thing out. And it never happened. Anyway, so you know, I'm getting ahead of myself because, you know, when I was a kid, we moved around a lot. I went to a lot of schools, and I never felt part of. I always felt different. I always, even with my own family, I felt different. So, you know, I share this because, again, there might be somebody out there thinking or feeling the same way. If you're an alcoholic or an addict, you probably feel the same way. And so you're not alone. This is a goddamn disease. It's cunning, it's baffling and powerful, and without help, it is too goddamn much for you. And I say this because I hate this goddamn disease. When I see people, like the other speaker was saying, people, he sees a lot of people go out, leave, and less than people than people say, I know that's true. Because, see, if you can tell someone what to do, and they won't do it. Last night we had a meeting that was following direction. By the time I got here, I was ready to do anything because I didn't know how to do anything anymore. I couldn't walk. I couldn't speak. I couldn't write my own name. I couldn't read. I couldn't work anymore. I couldn't drive. I couldn't walk. I couldn't do a goddamn thing. So I had no choice. I had pursued this thing into the gates of insanity. So all my life I felt that way. But I didn't know that. For a long time, when this thing worked, it was okay. I started trying to show how brave I was when I first, at the age of 14, my grandmother used to say, don't fight, don't be like the other guys, don't fight. At the age of 14, I made a decision, I was going to take care of myself. I started fighting and drinking, and two years after that, I was stabbed and died in the hospital. But I couldn't relate that to the drinking. I had no idea, it was just that I gotten caught. And my dad sent me to San Francisco. He told an uncle of mine, why don't you take this kid to the city with you? Because he's always getting in trouble over here. He's always hanging around with hookers and pimps and dope peddlers and all this stuff. So take him to the city with you. That's the best thing he ever did. I didn't drink or use up anywhere for a long time. I got a job. I started working. I went to school. I started my business almost the same time. It was a few years later that I started the business that I have now. By the way, today me and my wife have the best relationship we ever had. We're back in the same business. My son works with me. And I say this because, see, it's all because of Alcoholics Anonymous and God, as I understand them. And that's all. I don't take credit for nothing. All I do, I follow directions. I read the book and I try to do what they tell me. I try to follow directions because at that, when I first got here, that's all I could do. I couldn't do anything else. So when I was up in the city, I started working day and night. Otherwise, you know, I became a workaholic because otherwise I think I would have gotten here a lot sooner. I did that, and then I got married and came back here, and pretty soon I'm in business again, in the same business. We had children and stuff, and I worked all the time. I didn't have time to party too much. But once I had built the business up, the business had been growing. I remember one time I was in the San Jose store, because I had a chain throughout the state. I was in the San Jose store, and I said to myself, you know what, I had closed up, it was late at night, and I'm sitting there, and you can see the goddamn disease working already. I said to myself, you know what, this thing is all paid for, all the stores are paid for, the warehouse is full of merchandise, and it's all paid for, so maybe I can take it easy now. So I made a decision that night again. Software run riot, you know, and I made a decision. I called all the other guys, all the managers together, and I told them, you know, from now on, I want you guys, I'm going to give you guys a raise. I want you to take over a little more, you know, a little more responsibility, because I'm going to take it easy for a while. And I can see the pattern right there. Everything started going to hell, you know. But I started having a little more fun. I was in Vegas a lot. I flew to Hollywood for dinner, and I did all this stuff because I really loved that life at the time. And I had a real good time. I thought. You know, so today I look back and it was total insanity, man. That's all it was. You know, I thought I was having a good time and I was really dying is what I was doing. So what happened was that I kept it up and kept it up. And pretty soon, you know, I started getting seizures. Why I'm getting these goddamn seizures? Because I'm real tired. I'm working real hard. All this goddamn pressure. See, I tell you something. We used to go, me and my wife used to go to this Joe's downtown, original Joe's, you know, and have dinner there quite a bit. I used to go there, I used to drink there and all that stuff. Anyway, this one particular night, we were there and I had I don't know how many martinis and wine and drinks after dinner and all that stuff. The next morning I wake up and I talk about this because we're talking about Connie Baffling and Powerful. We're talking about the goddamn disease. And what happened was that the next morning, I'm throwing up, man. I'm really sick. I'm like, oh, God. You know, and you know what comes out of my mouth? That's fucking spaghetti. Not the booze, not anything, but the goddamn spaghetti. And I tell my wife, you know what? We're not going back to the goddamn place because they try to poison me. And you know what? And she believed it, man. We never went back. Because I believed it. And I never went back to sobriety. Now I go back. But, that's how cunning, baffling, and powerful is. And another time I was in Tahoe. I was there, and I was there for 3 days, and I had missed Christmas with the kids, and I really felt guilty about that for a long time. And I'm really sick in this little cabin up there, and I've got nothing to drink. And I'm on all fours like this, going, and I'm really sick, you know, and I say, geez, I got to get somebody to give me a half a pint of vodka. By then, all I wanted was a half pint. Because I'm praying, I'm saying, God, give me home, help me, and I'll never do it again. I'll try not to do it again. See, I was conning already. I'll try not to do it again, because I knew God damn well I was going to do it again. But I was praying, I'll go home to my family, and God, please help me. And you know how bad I felt. I found someone to give me a half pint of vodka. I paid $20 for a goddamn half pint of vodka. They went and got it for me, and I'm sitting on top of the bed, you know, and I'm really sick, and I took the half pint, I took a swig of that thing, and it stayed, you know, and then I took the second one, and it stayed, and I'm going, hey, what's happening? I'm okay again, and then right again. How do you come home? I went to the goddamn casinos. Total fucking insanity, excuse the language. But it's total goddamn insanity, you know, and it went on and on and on. I had no idea that I had a drinking problem. I thought I was just a little tired. And I started to follow directions. See, I'm good at following directions. They told me, well, Hank, if you take a little olive oil before you drink, you won't get loaded. You know, I took a half a goddamn bottle of olive oil. You know, I want to make sure I'll be okay. Or don't drink on an empty stomach. I was saving speed, man. I was never hungry. That was my problem. You know, I couldn't eat. And I'll never forget the first time this gal worked for me. She was from San Francisco. She worked for us in San Francisco. She worked for the office that I worked for before. And she came down to work for us. She'd take a bus from the city and come to San Jose. And this gal was partying every night. And she would tell me, I got home at 3 this morning. I had to get up at 5 to get a bus and come to work. But she looked terrific. I mean, she looked like she was asleep for 10 hours, you know. And finally I asked her, Connie, I said, how the hell do you do it, man? You don't do it once a week. You do it every goddamn night. And then she pulled out a couple of little pills, you know, and she says, well, you know, there's little bombs, she called them, you know. If you're ever a little tired, you're going to have a long day, you try a couple of this or one of this, she told me once, she gave me two. And I said, okay, I put it in my pocket, you know. I knew nothing about that stuff, I really didn't. And this particular day, we're having Christmas at home. See, Christmas Eve is my family, Christmas Day is my wife's side of the family. This particular day, we're having it at our house. And my wife had given me a pair of white silk pajamas. And I got these pajamas on. And all of a sudden, I remembered these little pills, these little bombs, you know. And I was trying, so I took a couple. I took them both, you know. And people are arriving to our house, you know. And all of a sudden, I grabbed the goddamn vacuum cleaner, you know. And I never cleaned out before. I mean, my wife did that. I work, man. And I'm vacuuming the whole goddamn house, you know. People are getting there and sitting down and pulling up their legs and going like this. I do the whole house, you know, and I still want to do more. I grab the goddamn toothbrush and stuff, and I wipe the toilets down and the walls and the tile. And we live in the county, you know, there's no sidewalks. So I'm out there sweeping the goddamn street. And these people are telling my wife, boy, what a good husband he got. This guy really something out, man. But see, I didn't know why. I was just busy as hell, you know. And I really like that stuff. After a while, I kind of became my connection. You know, she was giving me that stuff. And I did that for a long time. I remember one time I was coming back from Los Angeles. I went there quite a bit because they gave me an excuse to get loaded and party and all this stuff. So, and I was working those for a long time. And I'm running, I was like this, what's his name? That guy that does the Hertz commercials, O.J. Simpson. I was like him running through the goddamn airports, you know. And always running late, you know, where I rent a car to the hotel, the airport, and those were long tunnels, you know. And I get there and finally barely make this goddamn flight, and I sit down and I pull my tie like this, and I got a whiff of this rancid smell, you know. I said, my God, I thought the booze didn't smell out there. And it was me. I'll never forget that rancid smell, that I was dying. See, someone told me, look at you dying, Hank. And I saw myself, I still do it, I did a lot of those TV commercials, and I see myself on the screen on TV, and I see, man, something's wrong with this guy. My face was like this, you know, and all screwed up. But I didn't know what was wrong. See, I would ask people, I would ask my family, I would ask the guys who work for me, do I repeat myself a lot? And they say, yeah, I mean, you say the same thing over and over again. And I said, well, I want you to understand, because you probably got it, you don't get it, you know what I mean? And I kept on and on and on. I would ask everybody. My sister, my little cousin told me, you know what's wrong? I think you're coming down with a businessman's nervous breakdown. And I said, right on. I bought that one. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to take a week off. I went someplace, and I don't remember how the place was. But me and my wife went to this place. We were going to go to this health thing in San Diego. And we ended up in some place on the other side of the border. I forget what the hell the name of it is. And you had to get up and exercise every morning, and they gave you no meal. Everything was this vegetables and stuff put together, fixed. And I didn't do the exercise too well, but I found a guy with a fifth of brandy that owned a ranch over there, and I don't remember the rest of it. We're there a whole goddamn week, and I can't remember. Anyway, we came back, and obviously, you know, the book talks about those health farms, talks about the dieting, talks about the lifting weights, talks about all that stuff, and little changing from vodka to scotch or brandy, whatever the hell it is. I did all that. So when I read the book, I said, man, that's me. I tried all this shit. And I tried doctors, I tried nuns, I tried a Kenny Foreman at Faith Temple. Matter of fact, me and my wife went out there. My poor wife went with me, you know. Yeah, she... These Al-Anons are beautiful, man. They put up a lot of shit. You know, she went with me to the Faith Temple, and I'm up there trying to give it this shot, you know, and nothing's happening. Everybody's like, and I'm like this, too, and I'm looking around, nothing's happening, but I'm like this. And finally, they call people up on stage, up on the altar, whatever that is, you know, and I tell my wife, let's go up, because it ain't working down here. So I went up there. And let's get up there. And we got up there, and this guy, this Kenny Foreman, he's still on TV, you know, he goes like this to me. And there was guys out there catching you because you fell back. And I thought it was phony. That's why I really went up. You know, these guys are falling down. I mean, all the guy does is go like this and he fall down. They actually went boom, back. And my wife was with me, and this Kenny Foreman went like this to me. I forget what the hell he said, but he went like this. And I said this glow, this thing in his eyes, you know, and he went like this, and I swear to God, I went boom. And you know what my head says, he knows what to touch. If I can learn what I do to every apple in the river bar, you know what I mean? Somebody gives me a bad time, I go boom, boom, right down. See that? That's all I got out of that. You know, if Moses had parted the goddamn Red Sea, Lake Tahoe for me, I would have asked him to do it again the next day. Let me show me how you do it, really. And that's how I was. You know, the book talks about that we can't take things on faith like other people, like normies. You know, we gotta over and over and over again. You know, they talk about insanity. And, you know, the definition is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. And I would do that, you know, over and over and over again. So finally, you know what happened? I ended up at this treatment center. After all this stuff, after all this drinking, and by then, you know, I couldn't drink that much. I really could not drink that much. And towards the end, I got blackouts. I'll never forget this time. I went across the street, and I'm in there, and I remember that, you know, that little voice that still talks to me. You know, when I'm overeating, I get a signal that, hey, man, that's enough. You're going to get sick, you know? And I remember going like this, the glass, a little study glass like this, a little scotch. I'm going like this, and it's about that much left. And like a little voice told me, don't. I went, no. And that's all I remember. See, and the next thing I came to, four guys were throwing me out in the sidewalk. My head hit the cement, and I came to. And they told me, don't come back. And I knew all those guys. They were from across the street. They owned the bar for 30 years, 20-some years. And he said, don't come back, man, because we don't want any trouble. Don't come back. I walked across the street where I worked. And I went to my car, and by then I had the big stick, you know, and I'm opening the trunk trying to get this stick, and there's a little bakery right next door to us. I'm reading to something about God working in my life from way back there, and I didn't even know it. The little guy comes out of his bakery, and it's dark at night, and he comes out and says, no, man, don't go back, they're going to kill you. And he talked me out of it. Go home, Hank. I didn't know who the hell he was. And you know, and I did, and I went home instead of going back there. The next day I went back to the bar with a couple of guys. I had a boxing club upstairs. I took four of them boxing with me. Anyway, but settle the whole thing. But that guy that came out of the dark that night, I saw him at the Atlanta East like 4 days after, 4 years after I was there, I saw him at a meeting. Talk about God working in my life, okay? Talk about God running the show. See, when I get out, this wise, I don't know what I'm going to say, and you know, and I don't worry anymore, because see, if I say or don't say or you say too much or whatever the hell I say, it's not on me, because see, I've taken the whole steps, but the first step says that I admitted that I was powerless, that I'm powerless over alcohol, and that my life had become unmanageable. There's no step that says that I'm going to manage my life anymore on me. I got a new manager. I have a new employer now. I've taken my third step. My will and my life is in his care. He directs my will. He tells me what to do. Whatever comes up in my life is on him. All I do is show up. All I do, I was told, all you have to do is read the book and show up. Take the steps to the best of your ability and you'd be okay, Hank. Anyway, you know, when I forget where I was. We were at the bakery. We got back to the and I see this guy, you know, God working in my life, like I said. You know, what happened was all these things are happening. I was in the trial in Los Angeles with the LAPD. I was suing the LAPD. I was suing her to rent a car in the county and city of Los Angeles. I was over there for two. That trial went, I mean, they keep postponing that trial. It went for about 5 years, and the more resentful I got, the sicker I got. And so the book is right on. When he talks about resentment is the number one killer. Now, that book is right on. The more they postpone the thing, the pissed off, the more angry I got. Anyway, so what happened? I get over there, and in 5 seconds, what happened? The jury took a case, and we came home on Columbus Day. We went back, we flew back the day after, And I was spying him. My wife went to this thing in San Francisco to this prior thing in the city. We had a real good time. I hardly drank, and I'm an alcoholic, and I hardly drank that night. I was high, because I was in the bathroom in this Redondo Beach Hotel with all the attorneys and the private eyes and all these guys they hired, you know. We're there, we're having lunch, and he said, the jury's got it, but they made an offer. Do you want to take it, or do you want to let it go? I said, wait a minute, I'll be right back. I didn't tell him I was going to pray, but see, I always had a higher power. I went to the bathroom, and I knelt down and said, what do you do, God? And all of a sudden, I felt this release. Let it go. I came back and I told the attorneys that there is this. Let it go. Let the jury have it. We didn't pay no goddamn deals. And we came, we flew home, and that it was on a Friday night. That Sunday, and Saturday night, me and my wife went to that thing. Sunday was okay. Monday was a holiday. I got really loaded. I don't know why this guy came over. We had this bed, but we got loaded. Tuesday, we were flying back, and I'm really sick. And all I wanted to do is make a deal. And I'm in the bathroom in the courthouse, and the attorney comes over and, hey, the jury's coming in. You got a chance to make a deal. What do you do? I said, take the deal. We took $30,000. The jury comes in 5 seconds later with $260,000 tax-free. So I got a little resentful already. That's what happens when I run my life, see? When I take over and I don't let go and let God, like the third step tells me. See, essentially, these steps are a way of showing me how to let go and let God, and that's all it is, man. You know, so what happened after that? I got worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. Finally, I left my wife and kids, like I said, and I went to this. I was at my brother's house and we're drinking wine, and he had a sofa, sort of a round thing, this knockout, this vinyl thing, you know. And I would try to lay on it, and I'd get loaded, and I'd get sweaty, and I would barricade the doors, and I slide off and wake up and come to. I was like that for a long time. Finally, I saw this commercial on TV. That said, you know, is talking about Star Wars up in Scotts Valley that they closed recently. And what I saw was the mountains and foggy and trees, and I said, that's what I want, man. I want a nice, cool place so I can relax. Because if you know anything about speed and bruise, man, you sweat like hell. And I was always warm, you know. And so what I called them right away. I got the number. I remember I called. And I told him, well, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm not an addict. I'm not an alcoholic. I just want to relax. I want to go up and rest. Well, I'm sorry, we can't help you. And hung up on me. And by that time, somehow, I don't know how it happened, my sponsor called. And I told him where I wanted to go. And he wasn't my sponsor yet. He used to work for me, this guy. He used to be my advertising agency. And he said, well, why don't you go to Delphi? It's over in Calistoga. That's where he had gone. And I said, no, I don't want to go there. I want to go up here where it's nice and cool. You know, the same hard-headed alcoholic, you know. So he made a phone call, I think, and he got back to me somehow. The next thing I remember, I'm on my way up there. My son and my brother are driving me up there. And I remember being in the back seat. I'm still loaded. I'm still, hey, what's happening, you know? And we get there. And we get there, and I tell Jerry, the guy used to run the place, and I get off the car, I'm cocky as hell, you know, little asshole. And I said, you know what, man, if I like it, I'll stay for a week, maybe 3 days. If I really like it, I'll stay 10 days. And he said, yeah, get in there. So, you know, I got in there, and they put me in the room all to myself. And that ego, you know, baby, the goddamn ego gas, man. I said, boy, it pays to know the owner. You know, I get a room all to myself. Because I did know the guy that owned it, but I didn't know it at first, but I knew it later. And I was there for 3 days. The first thing I did was complain the next morning because they rang the goddamn bell too early, 6 o'clock. You know, and they say, wait a minute, I came here to relax. What is this bell shit for? You know, I mean, I don't want anyone breakfast. And they would give me Librium. See, I didn't know that. I thought it was vitamins. Anyway, to bring me down. And then they told me what it was, and I said, okay, fine. And this went on for a few days, you know, and I was cocky as hell, and I was sitting in these group rooms and these meeting rooms and stuff, and I was like laying in the back over there just sort of laughing at these people. I said, boy, these people, they come and tell them the same thing over and over again. They must really be stupid, man. You know, they can't. They, you know, if you don't take the first drink, you won't get loaded, anything does it, and all this stuff. And I said, I got it the first time they said it. And the same people come back and say the same thing over and over again, and it's the same people in the audience, and they still don't get it. I'm really screwed up, see? And then 3 days later, they took the living away. And the shit hit the fan, man. Jeez, I'm choking. I got a bubble or something in my throat. I can't even talk. I go to the nurse, and this girl, Judy, this blind girl, used to work because she was a nurse. She grabs me like this, you know, and I was, I didn't know what the hell I was feeling. She grabs me like this and puts my head in her bosom, you know, and it felt like, I felt like a little boy. I felt safe. And she called me an egotistical asshole, but you're going to be okay, just be fine to get the shit out. And she told me to go to this room with these other guys. And I didn't want to move because I want to be with myself. She told me, no, time's over. You know why I had the room to myself? I thought it was because I knew the owner. That was a detox room, and I was only one detox room, and that was why I was myself. So the bubble burst right away. So they got me to the other rooms, you know, and then I would go to this meeting room, and I would sit way in the back, and you know what I would do? I was going to say hotel, because at first I thought it was like a hotel. I would go and move the mattress off by the window and lay it on the floor, because I knew they were going to get me through the window. The same people had come back. See, and they found me, and they were looking for me. And I thought, well, what I'm going to do, I'm going to escape. I'm going to rock in the hills, but then my head says, you know what, man, they probably have these high-powered rifles and goddamn dogs, they're going to find you. I'm sharing this with you because that's why I was. See, and this program was, I share this with people because they can see how goddamn sick I was, and you too can recover. You too can recover. All you have to do is do what we did. And that's everything, you know what I mean? So anyway... I would sit way in back of the room, and there was this kid named Mike. He was a 15-year-old kid from over the hill of Santa Cruz, and he was really wired. They were giving him this goddamn, I forget what the medicine, the medication is. Anyway, we see each other in the hall and say, all we could say to each other, boy, am I wired, you know, I was really nervous. And I go in the room, way in the back, and I'm like this. He was really cold. Someone asked me a little while ago that he didn't recognize me because I didn't have a fur coat on. Well, that would be kind of tough to wear right now. But anyway, I had it on over there. And I would sit way in back of the room. And I would take inventories, you know. And there was this guy that would come in every Saturday and every Wednesday, no, Tuesday night or something. And I forget what his name, but he would say the same thing over and over again. He would say, my name is so-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic. And I feel a little squirrely. I guess it made me feel nervous, you know. And I thought, well, he's probably, you know, weak. That's why he feels that way. See, that's what I thought. And then, you know, these guys would get up and say, and he would say, you know, he would say, my name's so-and-so, and he would talk about his wife went off with his best friend, but it's okay. I go, wow. And then, and then he would say that, you know, they repossessed his car, but it's okay. And then my mouth would start opening up, you know. Then he'd say his daughter ran off with a plumber, but it's okay. I didn't know what he had against plumbers, but he hated those mothers, you know. And then he said they foreclosed on his house, but it's okay. And they just repossessed his car, and it's okay. And I thought, why don't you tell these other people? Don't give me that shit. It's okay, man. You know, that's where I was. I swear to God. That's where I was. And then I thought, you know, my head gave me all kinds of thoughts. You know, I'm saying to myself, you know what? This guy, I wonder what they pay him. So, you know, I wonder what they pay this guy. And my second thought was, they probably don't pay him too much because he's not that fucking good. See? I thought it was showbiz. You know, they had to come and entertain us. I mean, I had no idea what the hell was going on. I had no idea that I was an alcoholic. I had no idea that I was an addict. I had no idea what I was there for. All I knew that I thought I was in jail. They finally caught me, you know, and they finally nailed me, and I got to stay 30 goddamn days, man. That's all. I mean, if that's all you know right now, you're brand new, and that's all you know, stick around, man, because it's okay. You know, in spite of myself, it worked. See, and I would sit in the back of the room again. I say this because that's where I was, and I was trying to figure this thing out. And they had a refrigerator in the coffee room in the dining room that kept changing colors every day on me. I swear to God, one day it was polka dot brown, yellow with brown polka dots. The second day it was all brown, and I didn't want to ask who's painting this goddamn thing, you know what I mean? Because if they know that it's only me, you know, and I didn't think it was me, but I said, what's wrong with this guy? Who keeps painting this goddamn refrigerator? I found out nobody was me, but that's where I was. I mean, that's pretty goddamn sick, man. You know, and I'm in the hallway one time, and I'm telling my wife, see, I was there about 3 days when I first got there. And I called my wife because I saw this thing over the dining room, and by the dining room it says psych ward, you know. And I thought, whoa, man, I don't belong here. These people are nuts, you know, because everybody's walking in there. And I called my wife. There was a hallway leading from the office to this coffee shop, and in the hallway there's a phone. I get my wife on the phone. I call my wife, and I says, you know what, come and pick me up. These people are fucking crazy, man. I don't belong here. Come and pick me up. My wife said, why don't you give it another day? Stay there, you know. No, come and pick me up. I'm getting out of here. I said, okay, boom, I hung up. I turned around, and there's little Mike. And he's crying. Little Mike is crying. He says, "You're not leaving, are you, Hank?" And I looked at little Mike, you know, and something inside of me crumbled, man. Something inside of me, like a loaf of bread, like was in here, and it just crumbled. And I looked at little Mike, and I says, I paused for a while. You're not even. Finally, when this thing crumbled, I says, "No, Mike, I'm staying. It's okay." Again, I'm telling you, that was God working in my life. I picked up the phone. I called my wife. I says, "Forget it. I'm staying." He's what? "I'm staying. Forget it. Why? I'm staying. Forget it. Why? Tell me. Forget it. I'm staying." No, hang up. And I mean, really nuts, really fast. I was quick in those days, you know. I walked back to the dining room where we were having the meetings, and I sat down like where a lady sitting right there. I don't know where that lady sitting, like around there, you know. And the same nurse, the same one that was that helped me at first, the first 3 days, was chairing the meeting. And I sat down, and she's talking, and she's looking straight at me, and she says, "You know, if you're sitting here thinking you don't belong here, you're in the right place." And I go, "Whoa, they read minds," because that's exactly what I was thinking, see? I mean, I was really far, I mean, really screwed up. And I got really scared. I said, "Wow, she probably knows exactly what I'm going to think next. You know, I better clean it up." And I'm sharing this really because it's true, you know, because that's exactly what I got through telling my wife. And she couldn't have heard me because that's way the hell out in the other room. That come and pick me up, I don't belong, and I'm sitting there thinking I don't belong. In this broad time, if you're sitting there thinking you don't belong, you're in the right place. And bingo, I go, wow. Anyway, so I stayed, and I stayed, and finally, you know, I was there 3 weeks, about 3 weeks, and I was the only one that didn't get to go out for dinner with his family because I was pretty sick, man. I guess they didn't trust me, you know. Everybody gets to go out the first week, not me, I gotta say. So my wife and my mother picked me up, they took me to Danny's in Santa Cruz. And I'm so wired, you know, that this kid comes over with all his knives and this goddamn thing, and he dumps him, and I jumped about that high. And I told him, "Let's get the hell out of here. I can't stand this noise," you know. So we got out, and there's a guy's car in the middle of the road. These two kids are pushing this car. And instead of getting in the car with my wife and taking off, I go help them. I mean, you know, that's all right. I go help this guy. Did my good deed for the day, I guess. And we get the car started. I get back in the car with my wife. And we go to Kmart in SoCal. I tell my wife, "What I need is a TV set." There weren't a lot of TV set in it, but I'll buy a TV set. She drove me to SoCal. My wife did it again. You know, she took me over there. I walked inside of Kmart, and I grabbed this little TV, and finally I put it back. I said, "No, what I'll do, I'll buy this, a six-pack of socks." Not a six-pack of this, a socks. And I said, "Well, I don't know what I wanted socks for, but that's all I came out with." And I didn't come out with it. I went to the cashier with this. And there was two people in line, man, and I couldn't wait. And it was, oh, geez, fucking people. You know, I threw the things away and walked out. I get to the car, and what was left, because all the cars were repossessed. I was like that guy that said it was okay, but with me it wasn't okay. You know, everything was gone. We ended up with a 72 LTD that I had bought for my daughter years before that. And then my wife's driving, and my mother's in the passenger side, and I'm in the back seat. And all of a sudden, you know, this filthy word started coming out of my mouth. Words that I had never used before. They like you see those flags or those triangle things those car dealers hang on their cars that go around like this? I thought it was a bunch of that shit coming out of me, you know. And I even put my head down. I felt so ashamed. I put my head down, and like somebody was pulling all this filth shitty out of me, you know. And I get out the car when they park in front of my room. I get out the car and I walk to the front door, and I looked. I turned around, you know, and I looked at my wife and my mother. They're standing right by the door of the car, you know, behind, looking at me. I don't know what the hell is going on. They're looking at me, and I saw my mother say to my wife. She didn't say this, but that's what I thought, you know. She says, "You know, that's my son, but fuck him, it's crazy. Let's get out of here." And they took off, you know. And fast, they took off, you know. And then I started saying, my head goes to work again. He says, "You know what? That conspiracy worked, man. Those people that were after you, it worked. They turned everybody against you. Your little brother told you to go fuck off, you know. Everybody else did, and now your own mother and your own wife, they even turned against you. So this conspiracy worked." I walked inside my room, and I sat down, and I started laughing, because I admire a good con, you know. And I said, "Boy, this guy did a hell of a job. I'm going to learn this thing." You know, and see, that my mind was always like working like that. I'm going to learn this thing so I can do it to somebody else. And I started really laughing. And all of a sudden, you know, I have what I call my spiritual blackout. I got, like it talks about in chapter 4, the guy that says, "Who are you to say there is no God?" He was in conscious companionship with his creator. That happened to me. I had one of those things. And you know, I told you that I couldn't write my own name. I couldn't speak. I couldn't walk. I couldn't do a goddamn thing. Well, when I was on my knees, when I came out of that thing, you know, I was on my knees, and I read this piece of paper, and what came out of that was, "You will never be lonely or afraid anymore, and you don't drink like a squirrel." I mean, something beautiful came out, and I wrote it like that. It came out like that. I didn't write it. It came out like that. And this guy came to visit that night, and I was still Hanky the alcoholic. I was still in the same place, but everything was different. Everything was different. Everything was okay. No matter what, it's okay. And that's my third step, that no matter what, it's okay. So that night, this guy that had left came to visit. And he says, he looked at me right away, and it's the same thing this guy told Bill W. He says, "You know what, Hank, something's happened to you, man. You're different. You got serenity." And I said, "I don't know what happened, but I feel pretty good," because I forget what his name was. And the next morning, I went to this gal named Peggy. You know, she worked there. And she's we were talking one-on-one. And she says, "Oh, by the way, Hank, your insurance won't cover this thing. You know, it's lapsed in April, and this is November, in October." And you know what came out of me was, "Oh, it's okay, Peggy. You can't put a price on sobriety. Somehow I'll pay for it." No, like I was like the guy who said, "It's okay. No matter what, the insurance is going to end up pay for this $10,000-$12,000, but it's okay." You know, I found out what he was talking about. Right then and there, I found out that no matter what, it's okay. No matter what the hell's going on. And if you stick around here long enough, if you work this program, it'll work for you too. Because, see, I was in that place, and the same lady, I was complaining about, you know, before this happened, I was telling her, "You know what, I got to get out of here. My kids, my wife, the CPA, the attorney," you know. And she says, "You know what, Hank, can I got to get out and see my kids and my wife," and on and on and on. She says, "You know what, Hank, can I ask you something?" And I'll never forget this. She says, "Can I ask you something?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." I thought she was going to ask me some advice for business, you know, a big businessman. And she says, I said, yeah, what? She says, "Shut the fuck up." Whoa. And shocked me, and I did, yeah, because, you know, it was sudden. And then she went like this, and said, "You know what, Hank, if you don't make sobriety number one priority, you can forget your wife, your kids, your CPA, your attorney, your boat if you got one, and that's a promise." But then she went like this, "If you make sobriety your number one priority, and you work the steps to the best of your ability, you take the steps, even if you don't believe they work, you take them. It doesn't say you figure them out, you take them. And they'll work, and your life will automatically fall into place, and that's a promise. And that's what I'm telling you right now. If you take the steps, whether you believe them or not, just take them. Don't be like I did for a long time. I was willing to do this stuff, but I didn't understand for it. See, I wanted to understand every goddamn thing, and they told me, you got it ass backwards, man. Here we go. We do the action, and then you'll understand. But I wanted to understand. I wanted to believe first, and I wanted to understand everything. I wanted to feel it, and I wanted to know it before I believed it. And he says, no, you got it ass backwards, because, you know, here we do the action, and then you come to believe. That's what the second step says. It doesn't say you believe right from the gate. It says, came to believe. And, you know, and that's exactly the way it happened. And I thought that if I could only figure these things out, I'd be okay. If I could only figure this damn thing out, I'd be okay. And I would call my sponsor, and I would say, you know, what page do I read, man? Give me a break. See, I thought this guy was trying to get even, because I had given him a bad time when he used to work for me. And I thought, that son of a bitch trying to get even with me. You know, he said, that's why when I call him at 3 o'clock in the morning, see, I would do all this stuff. I was willing. I was willing to follow direction. I was willing to do anything because there was nothing left for me to do out there. I was into the gates of insanity. The doctor told me, because he examined you when you first get there, he told me, you know, you had from 3 to 6 months left. And I said, they didn't scare me. I didn't care. Because I think I wanted to go anyway because I was so goddamn miserable. But, you know, when I would call him at that time in the morning, you know, because I was really nuts, and they told me, you know what, you got to be willing to go to any lengths, basically Tijuana East. I love that place, you know, because I went there when I was really sick. I was really impressed with the young kids talking about God, the stuff little kids talking about God, because when I was a little kid, I didn't talk about God. I was ashamed. I was embarrassed. I believed in the higher power, but I never talked about him. So anyway, when this... when this thing happened, you know, I thought, wow, you know, if I could only believe like this kid believe, I'd be okay. So I kept coming back, and they told me, you don't drink even if your assholes are. You don't do anything. You don't take anything. You go to meetings, you keep coming back. And every time I went to a meeting, they keep coming back. The old timers, the people that were there would say, Hank, keep coming back. And I thought, see, that's good for the goddamn Eagles. Because when I got here, nobody wanted me. My family didn't want me. My friends didn't want me. I didn't even want me. So when people would say in this meeting, Hank, you know what I did? People introduced themselves for 30 days as newcomers. I did it for 120 goddamn days. You know why? Not because I loved it when they say, hi, Hank. See, I loved that. I felt like I belonged. I felt part of it, and I felt connected. Because the idea of this program is to find a power greater than yourself that will solve your problem. And if you connect with this higher power, that's all I need. That's all I have to do today is take the steps, clean house with the first 9 steps, find this power greater than myself, and connect with this power. See, the 10th step tells me that any time I am disturbed, it's a spiritual action, a spiritual truth, that any time I am disturbed, there's something wrong with me. I'm wrong. No matter what the cost. That was stuff for me to accept. That was stuff for me to buy. My sponsor said, you know what, Hank? You got to buy the whole thing or forget it. It ain't going to work. Because he told me, I'm not supposed to tell you this, but you're just like me. You're just another goddamn drunk. And it kind of pissed me off because I didn't want to be an alcoholic. See, I thought that if I could just learn to control this thing, I'd be okay. Once I learned how to relax, once I find the right pages in his right book, I'd be okay. But he wouldn't tell me. Like I said, I would call him at 3 in the morning, and I would say, Ed, I'm really screwed up. You know, I don't know what's going on. I feel this way or whatever. I don't know how I feel. Anyway, he says, you got a book handy? And I thought, my God, this guy, I'm dying. This guy wants me to read a goddamn book, man. Yeah. And I really thought this guy is trying to get even. Because, see, I knew that I really, you know, gotten over him and given him a bad time when he was loaded. Because, what helped me to get this sponsor was, again, God working in my life. He passed away 5 years ago, going on 6 years ago. Anyway, what helped me was that this guy knew me pretty well, very well. And what helped that I saw this guy when he was really sick. I saw him when he was really screwed up, and I couldn't believe it. I said, where the fuck are you, man? You know, I need you over here. He was the advertising agency. I'm trying to do some commercials, and this guy's in Acapulco. And I would really get pissed off at him. He goes, what the hell are you doing? I can say, can't you handle this shit? I remember telling my little brother, one time I told him, because I couldn't stand drunks. I had no tolerance for drunks. I couldn't stand a goddamn drunk. I thought they were weak and stupid, you know? I remember grabbing my little brother one time, and I'm grabbing him like this, and I said, man, if you can't control it, if you can't handle it, why the F do you drink, man? I was probably falling down myself, but I couldn't see it on me, you know? But I really told him that, and when this guy was supposed to be working for me, and he's out drunk in Acapulco, I said, shit, man, this goddamn drunk, you can't trust him. But I saw this guy, how sick he was, and then I saw him when he came to the program, I was still loaded. I'll never forget one time he walks in my office, and he gives me a little creepy looking smile, you know. And I said, this guy's got something. He's got a shitty smile, but he's got that stuff, you know. And something told me that this guy had found something. But I didn't know what it was, and I thought, well, maybe, but that's not for me. But see, if you keep coming back, man, and that's what the key to this thing is, keep coming back, don't take anything, and read the book. Because I was told that whatever I focus on, if I focus on something negative, it's going to get bigger. This guy told me that this is a law, this is a principle, that whatever I focus on is going to get bigger. And all I was focusing on was my pain and what they done to me, and I'm going to get even and all this shit. So he told me it's very simple. It's very simple. If you focus on the good, that's going to get bigger too. This thing will work whether it's on this side or this side. And he would tell me all stuff like that. I didn't believe it, but I tried doing it. I tried to follow direction, you know what I mean? But I still wanted to figure things out. I still wanted to do it my way because I knew somehow that I was sharper and that I would figure it out. And they told me the steps don't say, this is the steps we figured out. It says, this is the steps we took as a suggested program of recovery. Because people talk about, well, you're not sober, you're dry. I went to him, I says, you know, when am I going to sober up? And I got like about 3 or 4 months already, you know, and he says, man, you're as sober as you'll ever get. Now it's time to recover. You know what I mean? And then I was working those steps, and for a long time, you know, for a long time, I reverted right back. I did about 40 goddamn inventories, man, you know, because I wanted to get it right. See, I thought for a long time, and I took me 6 years before I snapped to this one. And it was because of a guy named Bob Rowe from down south that spoke up here. I caught him up at San Jose, but then another time in Moundville, Diolani was speaking up there. And he said, just the same way I felt, man, I thought that peace of mind meant no feelings. I believed it, right? And this guy says, you know what, I was here 14 years before I realized that the peace of mind does not mean no feelings. And it took him 14 years, I know it took me 6 because of him. So see, when somebody says something, you might pick it up, it might help you. It helped me, and I go, Bingo, that's me, man, I thought I wasn't supposed to feel anything. Because all I felt was fear and resentment and confusion and all this stuff. So anyway, what happened was that I started to work the steps. I started, and I somehow when that thing happened to me, when that spiritual blackout happened to me, I took the first 3 steps. I could see the scales fell from my eyes, man. Like the other big book says, you know, the scales will fall from your eyes and you will see. And they told me, don't try to set things right. Try to see them right. I could see everything. I could see that I was an alcoholic. I could see that I was powerless over alcohol. And I could see that my life was unmanageable. And I could see that a higher power has done all this for me. And I could see that he was running the show. And all of a sudden I felt this. You know, I don't care what happens in life. The third step will come sudden in. No matter what, it's okay. So see, what that guy was saying every night for all that time, that it's okay, you know, all this shit, worked for me. Because if I stayed here, if you stay here, it'll come to happen for you. It'll work for you. And I say this, man, because, you know, all this time, I thought that it would not work for me. Because, see, I would call my sponsor at 2 or 3 in the morning, and I would tell him, and he would say, read the book. You know, just read the book. And I said, Ed, it don't work for me. You know, I read one line. By the time I got to the second line, I forget what the hell the first one said. Man, so how am I going to retain anything? And he says, you don't have to. And I said, I don't understand it. And he told me, you know what, Hank? Don't try to understand it. Just read it. Don't even try to understand the goddamn thing. Just read it. You got to be willing to do those things, and your higher power will do the rest for you. And you know what? I'll never forget this time. I'm trying to hurry because time's running out. I'll never forget this time that I was in that same room in that hospital. And when that happened, you know, I had like a voice tell me, you know what, Hank? You've been a goddamn liar all your life. You've been lying. You've been bullshitting all your life. And now it's time to get honest. And I have some steps for you. By the time you get to the 9th step, all those great promises will happen for you. And if you're not willing, just pray for the willingness. And I heard already in Los Gatos at a Friday meeting, and an old lady about 70 years old, man, and it stuck with me. She said, you know what? The topic was willingness. And she says, you know what? I'm not willing all the time. It's either too hot, too cold, or too wet, or too hot, or too dry, or whatever. I'm not willing all the time. So what I do, I pray for the willingness to be willing, to be willing, to be willing, to be willing. And I go, bingo, that's what I need to do. So see, all those meetings help, man. You know, people say things that I could use. And you know, and all I can say to you is keep coming back, because this thing works. In spite of myself, I'm here today. I'll be coming up in 15 years, God willing. And I love this program because it saved my life. And all I can tell you is keep coming back. It works. Thank you very much.